Alois the Tsar didn't have to strain his empty head over a lot of theory. Lenin took whatever he could understand of Marxist theory and used it to his own advantage, and Stalin took whatever he could understand of Lenin's theory, which wasn't much, and used it to his own advantage. The narrower a man's intellectual grasp, the more power he is able to grab in this country. I tell you, Lieutenant, there is only one way to survive here, and that is not to imagine anything. A Russian who uses his imagination is done for. I certainly never use mine. My job is to make others use their imaginations. That's my bread and butter. Make sure you keep that in mind. As long as you are in here, at least, picture my face if you ever start to imagine something and say to yourself, "No, don't do that. Imagining things can be fatal." These are my golden words of advice to you. Leave the imagining to someone else.
Half a year slipped by like this. Now the autumn of 1947 was drawing to a close, and I had become indispensable to Boris. I was in charge of the business side of his activities, while the Tatar was in charge of the violent side. The secret police had yet to summon Boris back to Moscow, but by then he no longer seemed to want to go back. He had more or less transformed the camp and the mine into his own inviolable territory. And there he lived, in comfort, steadily amassing a huge fortune, protected by his own private army. Perhaps, too, rather than bring him back to the center, the Moscow elite preferred to keep him there, firming their foothold in Siberia. A continual exchange of letters passed between Boris and Moscow, not using the post office, of course. They would arrive on the train in the hands of secret messengers. These were always tall men with ice-cold eyes. The temperature in a room seemed to drop whenever one of them walked in. Meanwhile, the prisoners working the mine continued to die in large numbers, their corpses thrown into mine shafts as before. Boris did a thoroughgoing assessment of each prisoner's potential, driving the physically weak ones hard and reducing their food rations at the outset so as to kill them off and reduce the number of mouths he had to feed. The food diverted from the weak went to the strong in order to raise productivity. Efficiency was everything in the camp. It was the law of the jungle, the survival of the fittest. And whenever the workforce began to dwindle, freight cars would arrive packed with new convicts, like trainloads of cattle. Sometimes as much as 20% of the shipment would die on the way, but that was of no concern to anyone. Most of the new convicts were Russians and Eastern Europeans brought in from the West. Fortunately for Boris, Stalin's politics of violence continued to function there. My plan was to kill Boris. I knew, of course, that getting rid of this one man was no guarantee that our situation would improve in any way. It would continue to be one form of hell or another. But I simply could not allow the man to go on living in this world. As Nikolai had said, he was like a poisonous snake. Someone would have to cut his head off. I was not afraid to die. If anything, I would have liked Boris to kill me as I killed him. But there could be no room for error. I had to wait for the one precise moment when I could have absolute confidence that I would kill him without fail. When I could end his life with a single shot. I continued to act the part of his loyal secretary as I waited for the chance to spring on my prey. But as I said earlier, Boris was an extremely cautious man. He kept the Tatar by his side day and night, and even if he should give me a chance to get him alone sometime, how was I to kill him? With my one hand and no weapon. Still, I kept my vigil, waiting for the right moment. If there was a God anywhere in this world, I believe the chance would